I'm going to pray real quick. Blessed are you, Adonai, our God, King of the universe, who has chosen us from every people, exalted us above every tongue, and sanctified us with his commandments. And you gave us, Adonai, our God, with love, Sabbaths for rest, appointed festivals for gladness, festivals and times for joy, this day of Sabbath, and this day of the festival Shavuot, the time of the giving of our Torah, with love, a holy convocation, a memorial of the Exodus from Egypt. For you have chosen us and you have sanctified us above all the peoples and the Sabbath. In your holy festivals, in love and in favor, in gladness and in joy, have you granted us as a heritage. Blessed are you, Adonai, who sanctifies the Sabbath and Israel and the festive seasons. May the expressions of my mouth and the thoughts of my heart find favor before you, Adonai, my rock and my redeemer. He who makes peace in his heights, may he make peace upon us and upon all Israel. Vayimru.
Amen.
Okay. So, I am Adam Haynes. I've been at Beth Tikkun for roughly 8 years. You may recognize me by appearance or voice as the guy that asks a question every week, or at least I make a comment in question form. To that end, that's the skill set I have, question asking. I have significantly less experience in the sitting up here and speaking department. With that in mind, I've come to think of today's teaching as a sort of a journey, an ambitious, rambling marathon journey. Please do not be alarmed at the pace I throw out references. For the verses I really need you to look at, I'll say, you know, turn to. The rest are really there for people with notebooks and pause buttons and a desire to double-check my quotes. Because of limitations of time and me, I will ignore raised hands, unless my wife raises her hand, but that's just because I'm well-trained. If anyone has any questions, they can email them to me, and I will respond in an untimely manner. If you cannot find my email, just use mail@bethtikkun.com. Finally, as I ask questions today, I will pause and give you time to think, but I will not be calling anybody, so don't worry. They're all functionally rhetorical. Anyways, what are we studying today? Here's a clue. It is the only book of the Bible written because someone did not listen to their mother. It's Ecclesiastes. That's in Hebrew there. So my goal in this teaching is to equip you to study Ecclesiastes by providing a few foundational insights. Consider Luke 24. Jesus is at a fish fry with his disciples, and he loosely summarizes for them the special instruction he gave to them over the past 7 years, or several years. These are my words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all the things that are written about me in the law of Moses, and the prophets, and the Psalms must be fulfilled. What he communicates is that there are prophetic references to Messiah throughout the Hebrew Scriptures, even in Ecclesiastes. Now, I've chosen not to reveal any of them today, but I want to equip you to find them. After all, it is the glory of God to conceal a matter, and the glory of kings is to search out a matter. And the beginning of wisdom is, acquire wisdom, and with all you're acquiring, get understanding. Consider for a second pigs and sheep. Peter is commanded, tend my sheep. But Jesus commands a great crowd, do not cast your pearls before swine. Now, one of the differences between sheep and pigs is their diet. Pigs are something like the perfect garbage disposal. They're practically designed to live off of other people's scraps, whereas sheep are quite the opposite. They're designed to eat something fresh, take a while to work on it, and return to it several times. This is called chewing the cud. It's one of the characteristics that make sheep kosher and therefore qualified as food. It's called ruminating. The sheep chews and swallows food and begins to digest it. Later, it regurgitates it and chews it some more. I believe this comparison illustrates the truth about how we should learn, and by extension, how a shepherd should teach. I do not believe that a teaching should be entirely little chunks of small thoughts. I believe that there should be a need to meditate on a teaching and find areas that stand out and then do personal studies follow-up. Whether or not I will be successful, it is my hope that this teaching will provide you with nourishment for the entire week, assuming you ruminate on it. Well, let me give you a loose outline for today. Before we look at Ecclesiastes itself, I will try to establish a bit of the context for the book. When was it written? Why was it written? What was going on while it was written? But before I do that, I should probably address my claim that Ecclesiastes was written because Solomon ignored Bathsheba. Now, after we have a fix on the context of the book, I'm going to throw a smattering of verses at you. The goal will not be a systematic presentation of the book, if that were even possible. Ecclesiastes is a chaotic piece of work. I simply want to help you develop a familiarity with some parts of the book. In the midst of our sampling of verses, I'll zoom in briefly on chapter 3 to discuss a worthwhile discovery. Then I will suggest a couple of verses to consider studying on your own. Finally, I will take a second to present my overall sense of the book and propose a response to it. To begin with, we need to consider that at the core of this book is neglected maternal guidance. Now, to be fair, we all probably have a chapter in our life story where we ignore our mothers. We just didn't make it into the Bible. Solomon wrote 3 books, Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, and the Song of Solomon. At the end of Proverbs is a chapter for Solomon from Bathsheba. In verses 10 to 31 of chapter 31 is a section we call the Eshet Chayil, or the excellent wife. Now, in many Sabbath-keeping homes, the husband reads this section at the Erev Shabbat meal to bless their wives. The Eshet Chayil is a description by Bathsheba for Solomon regarding his future queen. She's essentially saying, "Son, let me tell you what to look for in a woman." Bathsheba understands that a good queen is critical to a solid kingdom. Consider Esther. In the account of her life, we see the 2 primary roles of a queen. First, from Esther 1:17-18, she was to act as a guide to the wives of the country. And second, from 4:14, she was to balance and oppose the queen, or the king. The former was her royal role, and the latter her wifely role. So what sort of woman was Solomon supposed to look for? She was supposed to be the sort of woman that the ladies of Bethlehem could look up to, the sort of woman you'd find worth emulating. He could trust her. She's good to him. She works alongside him. She provides for the household, and she's a good steward of family resources. She has a noble spirit, is strong and dignified. She's praised by her family, not just casual observers, and she fears the Lord. Now, while we can assume a passionate pursuit based off of the Song of Solomon, we have no account what Solomon's first wife was like or what their relationship looked like. Regardless, we can assume that some of his other 699 wives were pagans and idolaters, and they did not fear the Lord, and they drew Solomon into idolatry. Now, right before the Eshet Chayil, Bathsheba gives Solomon 3 pieces of direct and simple advice. Do not give your strength to women. Do not drink wine or desire strong drink. Defend the afflicted and the needy. I do not have any definite account regarding the 3rd one, but we'll see shortly that Solomon ignored the 2. Perhaps, had Solomon listened to his mother, had he not given his strength to women, had he chosen and stuck with 1 God-fearing wife, had he not set out to indulge in strong drink, perhaps we would not have had Ecclesiastes. But perhaps this was meant to be. With that said, let's look at the context of the book. After all, it didn't simply appear in our Bibles. It was written by hand by a man in the Middle East centuries and centuries ago. It was copied. It was passed down. Ecclesiastes was written by the son of David, king in Jerusalem. To really appreciate that title, we need to start at the end of Judges, where it says, "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." And stepping forward in the book of Samuel, the elders of Israel make a demand of Samuel. They state, "You are old. Your sons are the wrong sort of bold. We want a king making proclamations just like all the other nations." Israel did not have a king. They had personal responsibility, but they felt a king would be better. And this alarmed Samuel, who brought it before God, who responded, "Listen to the people. They've not rejected you. They've rejected me as king over them." And Samuel returned to the elders and explained the costs of having a king, but they insisted on a king. The first king was Saul, who was replaced by David. David abducted and impregnated a woman and then had her husband killed. The child resulting from that first pregnancy died, but Bathsheba had a 2nd son, Solomon. After some intrigue, Solomon became king over Israel and king in Jerusalem. Now, one of Solomon's first actions, it was 4 years into his reign, was to build the temple. 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 38 states, "So he was 7 years in building it, the temple." Then in the next chapter we read, "Now Solomon was building his own house 13 years, and he finished all his house." And this is reiterated in a couple chapters. It came about at the end of 20 years in which Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house. I might have glazed over that piece of history had it not been mentioned a second time. Why did God find it necessary to have this recorded twice? He wanted the reader to notice that Solomon was building two houses, not just physical houses, but spiritual houses. He had divided his heart and his attention. Consider Matthew's gospel. Jesus is teaching a crowd, and he says, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." As we have read, it will become apparent that Solomon was dividing his attention between two masters, the two houses. And over time, the world won out. Consider also James's statement that the two-souled man is unstable in all his ways. Solomon was building for himself two souls, one directed towards the temple and the other facing his palace. Surely there were times when he was pulled in two different directions. And I believe that part of the hectic tone of Ecclesiastes is due to Solomon's instability. The entire book seems to be a collection of scattered thoughts, which perhaps it was. One other thing of note, which may have nothing to do with Solomon. When he constructed the temple, he brought the ark into it. And the account specifies, "There was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone, which Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel when they came out of Egypt." Now, why did that grab my attention? Consider Hebrews 9. The Ark of the Covenant, in which there was a golden jar holding the manna and Aaron's rod, which budded, and the tablets of the covenant. So the rod served as a reminder of the rebellion, so that they would remember their grumbling against God. And the jar served to remind them of the Exodus and of God's provision. The tablets served to remind them of the covenant and that they were God's chosen people. But at this time, Israel was forgetful. The people forgot about their grumbling against God and God's provision for them, and they demanded a king. Now, in quick summary, Solomon was divided, and the people elevated him. He accumulated 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horsemen, 700 wives, and 300 concubines, and his heart was turned to idols. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 17, anticipating that Israel would eventually have a king, God gives a few specific laws. Of particular note here, it says, "He must not multiply horses, and he must not multiply wives." The word is yarbeh. It means to increase greatly. And this command links multiplying horses to returning to Israel, or returning to Egypt, and multiplying wives to being led astray. Now, reconsidering the ark, there's an interesting alignment in what was lacking. The manna to remember being led from Egypt was missing, and the king was to refrain from multiplying horses, lest they return to Egypt. And the staff to remind them not to rebel was missing, and the king was to refrain from multiplying wives, lest they be led astray. Deuteronomy 17 contained clear commands to the king, with warnings. Solomon disobeyed them and became an idolater. In 1 Kings 11:11, God says to Solomon, "I will tear the kingdom from you." And then in verse 43, we read of Solomon's death. I believe that it is when Solomon the king was worshiping idols, amassing wealth, and hunting down perceived threats to his power that Ecclesiastes was written. I believe there was a small part of Solomon struggling. Solomon's servant of God surfaced during the occasional moment of quiet time, and he meditated on his life, considered the worthlessness of so much of it, and considered if he could turn his life and his kingdom around. And in these moments of reflection, he penned Ecclesiastes. Let's take a second to turn to Ecclesiastes if you've got a Bible and you're not already there. It's right in the middle somewhere. Now Ecclesiastes begins, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity." I am not content with this translation. It may have worked when it is first written, but English has changed. I have mixed feelings about the title preacher. It may have once meant one who gathers people to hear the word, but today it seems to have transformed into one who sermonizes. I think the role's been cheapened into talk, and often not worthwhile talk. But the word translated here as preacher is kohelet. Kohelet is a term for something different. And for one, it's not a term of religious office. Now, kohal, the root of kohelet, refers to an assembly, a convocation, or a congregation. Translators would translate this into church if they encountered it in the apostolic writings. Now, the idea of the kohal is important. The Sabbath and the holy days talk about and assume a holy convocation, or a set-apart gathering. And at the center of the Torah is the assumption that our walk is one done in a community. There's no such thing as Shabbating, or keeping the Moedim alone. There are many reasons for this, but one of them is indicated in John 13:35. "By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." Consider also 1 John 4:20. "If someone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he's a liar. For the one who does not love his brother, whom he has seen, cannot love God, whom he has not seen." Love is not a feeling. Love is not a thought. Love is an action. Love is on the terms of the people you're loving. Without loving and serving closely alongside people, you simply cannot truly know if you love or hate your brother. Kohelet, or Ecclesiastes, is the title of this book because it's the title the author assumes. It might best be translated as gatherer or collector, because congregator sounds odd. If we are translating from the Greek of the Septuagint, we would use assemblyman. I prefer the title summoner. I like this because a summons is given to move people from one time, one place, or one situation to another. By giving himself the title of Kohelet first, son of David second, and king in Jerusalem third, Solomon is revealing his heart. The book of Ecclesiastes is designed to move us, not figuratively like a sappy movie, which moves the emotions, but you leave the same person you came as, but literally. Ecclesiastes wants to scoot us a little bit closer to God and a bit away from the world. I like to think of Ecclesiastes as the on-ramp to the Bible. I mentioned that Ecclesiastes is designed to move us, and I want to take a few minutes to elaborate on that point. Movement in the spiritual realm is nothing like movement in the physical realm, because there's no physical distance to change. There's only one dimension of movement, which is closer to or further from God. When we're closer to God, we're more complete, and when we're further, we're emptier. And it's not a matter of distance, but it's a matter of fullness. It's like a mirror and a candle in a dark room. When the mirror is close to the candle, it reflects the entirety of the flame. The mirror is serving its purpose, and the room is brighter. But when the mirror is far, it doesn't change the mirror physically. But not only does it reflect less light, it begins to fade from sight. Ecclesiastes communicates to us that we should not lose sight of the spiritual because we are so focused on the physical. Habael Habalim, typically translated as vanity of vanities. Habael Habalim is an exponential reference. Some translate it as vapor of vapors, and this is more true to form. If we went from the Septuagint, we would have uselessness of uselessness. For the mathematically minded, it's like comparing the substance of a sphere in three dimensions to a mere line in one dimension. Now, if you wanted to be poetic, you could say shadow of illusions. And if you wanted to be juvenile, you could say like a fart in a windstorm. The idea is that if the smell of French fries heightens rather than calms your hunger, then how much less satisfying is a picture of those French fries? This word hebel, it first appears in Deuteronomy in the Song of Moses. On behalf of God, it says, "They have provoked me to anger with their idols, so I will make them jealous of those who are not a people." Here, hebel is translated as idols. When Solomon chooses to use the word hebel in his introduction, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity," he's linking the worthlessness of idols to the temporary nature of activity in this world. The main message of Ecclesiastes, as it is introduced by Solomon, is that he, the summoner, is calling us to a place where we see that human activity, if limited to this world, is ultimately meaningless and potentially idolatrous. And that's a tad discouraging. On that note, we need to recognize that this book has a jarring effect. It's designed to shake us out of a non-reality. For everyone who has read it, especially us modern Romans, Ecclesiastes is a useful tool for looking at our environment, our personal religion, and ourselves. Ecclesiastes is the product of a man listening to the voice of the prince of this world, who applied his great wisdom to very low tasks. A man who is nearing the end of his life and is trying to sort out the mess he made for himself and his nation. Chapter 1, verse 9. There is nothing new under the sun. Chapter 2, verse 11. There was no prophet under the sun. Chapter 8, verse 15. There is nothing good under the sun. Now, each of these three verses has something in common: under the sun. It's not a religious construct, an idea, a concept, or a literary device. It's something literal, a concrete place. Now, in order to consider what under the sun refers to, we need to start with the sun. Now, if we looked at Genesis 1, verses 14 and 18 together, you can bookmark Ecclesiastes, we'll return to it. But go ahead and turn to Genesis 1, 14, 18. It's just a little easier if you look at it. It would be like page 2 or 1. In verses 14 to 16, God calls into being light bearers or luminaries in order to be in the firmament, separating day from night, to be for signs, appointed times, days and years, and to be for lights in the firmaments to give light on the earth. Then in verses 17 to 18, he creates the two great light bearers. One is to govern the day, and one is to govern the night. And they are also to give light on the earth. And they are also to separate the light from the darkness. Now, without going overboard with exploring this section, we can see quite simply that the sun was made to give light on the earth. Under the sun refers to the realm of normal human experience and existence on this earth. While well-meaning readers might want to make the setting of Ecclesiastes a dark place and proclaim that under the sun is a place of evil, it is not. All right, let's return to by those three verses in Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new, there's no prophet, there's nothing good. Let's start with chapter 2, verse 11. There was no prophet under the sun. For people that are listening, that's prophet Ching Ching, not prophet Here Comes a Flood. Now, this describes Solomon's life experience, his amassing of wealth, and yet there was no prophet under the sun. Now, here's the shakeup. For all the things he did, all the stuff he accumulated, there was no prophet under the sun. It says that Solomon made silver as common as stones and cedar as plentiful as sycamores. But Solomon says that he had no prophet under the sun. Now that caught me off guard as a modern reader, and perhaps it got you too. I think it's downright un-American. No. But we're constantly bombarded by and typically embrace the message that getting more possessions is the answer to our problems. So this verse, that there is no prophet under the sun, it's slightly jarring. Even though it aligns perfectly with Jesus' statement, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth." Solomon casually dismisses vineyards and parks, fruit trees and servants, gold and singers. All is vanity. Let's move to chapter 8, verse 15. There is nothing good for man under the sun. Now, if you did not pay attention to the prepositional phrases for and under, You would be left with a blatant lie. And yet, one that too many people accept broadly. Too many people believe there is nothing good. Or there's nothing good for man. Or there's nothing good under the sun. But it specifies, there is nothing good for man under the sun. In the midst of creation, God declares it good more than once. Have to remember, we're dealing with this physical realm of work, a world of physical change and accumulation, the realm beneath the luminaries. So here, in the context established shortly ago in chapter 1, verse 9, where so many great accomplishments are vanity, and there's nothing good for a man under the sun. And by now, a few of you have to be going crazy, because I'm not reading the entire verse. The full verse reads, there is nothing good under the sun except. All right, we have an except. There is something good for man under the sun. Except to eat, to drink, and to be merry. This will stand by him in his toils. That's a rough break for the teetotaler, the fast food eater, and the bump on the log, because it seems to suggest changing your game. Now, could you imagine going to your pastor looking for advice on how to change your life for the better? And his response was, well, you need to host a barbecue this summer. There should be beer, all beef hot dogs, and some lawn games. This verse encourages us to eat and to drink and to be merry because it will stand by us in our toils. We see this in 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 20. The people are eating and drinking and being merry. But it's not enough on its own. But this simple idea of the sustaining power of a gathering, even without the deeper spiritual element of fellowship, it captures the social nature of humans. The idea expressed in this verse is why my wife and I try to host an Erev Shabbat dinner at least once a month. It's the reason we try and come to the Oneg meal every week, and it's the reason we prefer home-cooked meals shared together at the table. Like I said earlier, this is a community walk. When we abandon fellowship to pursue vain busyness, we don't have anything to carry us through our toil. We cheat ourselves of something good. There will always be some sort of toil, but our time here is limited. Do you remember what Jesus said to Martha? Martha, Martha, you are worried and bothered about so many things, but only one thing is necessary, for Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from her. Can you imagine being before the throne and being held accountable to the good under the sun that we refused to experience? Looking back to chapter 1, verse 9, we read one of the most quoted verses of this book. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Now, this verse is not here to tell us a story about specifics. It wasn't waiting for some guy in the Industrial Revolution with the reminder that the ancient Greeks had a steam engine. This verse is talking about the essence of the realm under the sun. Whatever we do will eventually be forgotten. The workers that built and the priests that imagined Stonehenge, forgotten. The kings that designed and the slaves that built the pyramids in Egypt, forgotten. The citizens that lived in and the rulers that reigned in the great cities of ancient Central America, all forgotten. The traded horses and resins and gold through Israel, connecting Africa and Egypt, the Mediterranean. The trade in spices and silk that connected Spain to Turkey, to India, to China. The trade in sugar, cotton, and humanity that linked America, Europe, and Africa. All a part of the past. But we build our cities. We carve out islands in the sea and make oases in the desert. We make towers that scrape the sky and pits that gouge the earth. We trade in rare metals mined by children in Africa and clothing made in sweatshops in the Far East and food grown with toxic chemicals here in America. And we think, we have something new. We have cities and monuments and trade. We are arriving. Humanity is advancing. But there's nothing new under the sun. That which has been is that which will be. And that which has been done is that which will be done. This verse, perhaps more than the other two, should really get us to consider what it says and what it does not. There is nothing new under the sun. What about above the sun? The sun governs the day. It separates light from dark and gives light to the earth. But what about that light from day one? Is that the same light as what the sun deals with? Consider John 1. In the beginning was the Word. All things came into being through him. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. Messiah is far above the sun. If you need convinced on that point, read Psalm 104. So the question becomes, if there is nothing new under the sun, is there anything new above the sun? We find an answer in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 17. If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old things pass away. Behold, new things have come. Before under the sun even existed, there was the Word. It is infinite. And when we engage it, we step outside of the restriction of nothing new under the sun. When we meditate upon Scripture, we drink from an infinite source. And I believe that when we study, and study deeply, we encounter God. And we have the potential to bring something new into this world. Now, flipping casually through Ecclesiastes, we see that Solomon speaks poorly of human activity. It's essentially unoriginal, profitless toil. And he goes a step further in chapter 1, verses 13 to 14. There he says, "It is an evil task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind." I want to focus in on that first part. It is an evil task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. That's pretty rough. To me, it seems uncharacteristic of God to make the bulk of our lives an evil task. But first, let's look at that phrase at the end, to be afflicted with. Why is man afflicted by this task? Genesis 3, verse 17. "Cursed is the ground because of you, and toil you will eat of it all the days of your life." But now let's consider that evil task. Why an evil task? Deuteronomy 30 reveals the issue. It says, "This commandment I command you today is not too difficult for you, nor is it out of reach. The word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may observe it. See, I have set before you today life and good, and death and evil, and that I command you today to love the Lord your God." You see the reason for Solomon's evil task in that last sentence. "I have set before you life and good, and death and evil." What is that evil task Solomon refers to? Life under the sun without obedience. God gave man an evil task. He also gave man a good task. It's the exact same task. He said, "I have set before you today life and good, and death and evil, in that I command you today to love the Lord your God." If you keep that command, it's life and good. But if you abandon it, it becomes death and evil. Consider John 14, verse 15. "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." Now, as a quick aside, if you bring this simple paradox with you to books like Romans and Galatians, it is so much easier to understand when they talk about the law. Now, Solomon has this negative tone about human activity, but he recognizes that God is eternal. Even as he writes this gloomy book, he still affirms the reality of God. In chapter 3, verse 14, he writes, "I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take from it. For God has worked that men shall fear him." Now, while man's work is without profit, fading like the morning mist, God's work is not. Tucked into this somewhat depressing book about the disappearing act of human accomplishment, we get that simple reminder. Everything God does will remain forever. It talks about the fundamental nature of God's activity and his revelation to man. There's nothing to add to it. There's nothing to take from it. This, in essence, is why we have that command in Deuteronomy 4, chapter 2. "You shall not add to the word which I am commanding you, nor take away from it." It's finished. There's nothing to take away or to add. And this explains why our master says, "I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill." Everything God does will remain forever. Contrasted against this, however, we see ourselves in chapter 12, verse 17. Regarding the end of our lives, we read, "The dust will return to the earth as it was, and the breath will return to God who gave it." Where else do we see a combination of dust and breath? Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. "Then the Lord formed man of the dust of the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." Nefesh chai. We know that God had declared, "Let us make man in our image and in our likeness." But then it says he made man in his image. He leaves the likeness making as an ongoing act of co-creation. We know that when God speaks, he speaks from his nature, and his words and his will are consistent with who he is. His express will, his law, that's the pathway to his likeness. And this is the entire ministry of Christ, to live a perfect life, in part so that we could see a full and complete likeness of God in a human vessel. In making ourselves his disciples, we could emulate him. But it's this labor, the journey towards likeness, that is not vain. When we die, the dust returns to the earth and the breath to God. We're no longer a living soul. That image departs, but the likeness remains. All of Ecclesiastes seems to jump around. One tidbit is totally random. Look at chapter 9, verses 14 to 17. So there's this small city. It gets besieged by a great king. A poor wise man delivers the city, and nobody remembers the wise man. Really? What is he talking about? Consider Proverbs 16:32. "He who rules his spirit is better than he who captures a city." So this connects the idea of the city and our spirit. In that story, chapter 9, verses 14 to 17, you are the city. And you are besieged by the spirit of this world, or the prince of lies, or your evil inclination. And your desire for righteousness, or your conscience, or your good inclination, they help you escape. But why does the story mention that nobody remembers the wise man? When our hearts are divided, or immature, or just broken, we have a strong memory for when we screw up. And when we narrowly escape temptation, we vividly remember the temptations, but not the overcoming. It almost seems that the past is as present as the present, instead of looking towards the future. We need to embrace the truth of redemption. It's easy to forget all the times when we resisted fleshliness and chose life and good. And those times when we really screw up, when instead of listening to the wise man, we ignore him and our city gets destroyed, we need to rebuild the city, rebuild the walls, and remember to listen better next time. Now, I want to take a little bit of time to look at time. So please turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Because while this chapter may seem pretty simple, there's surprising depth here. It begins, "There is a set time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven." Now, Rabbi Natan Slifkin, in his book Seasons of Life, provides us with an unassuming definition. Time is the framework within events and changes occur. When we read this verse, we encounter two different words. One translated as set time, and one translated as time. Before we begin, I want to point out that neither word is moedim. The moedim are the appointed times. And more importantly, this word describes all of the holy days that we have a right and responsibility to keep and sanctify. This chapter does not deal with the moedim. There is a set time for everything, and there's a time for every event under heaven. Substituting from the Tanakh with the Hebrew, we have there is a zemen for everything, and there's an eight for every event under heaven. Zemen is a set time, something fixed into a pattern, whereas eight is more dynamic, like the seasons. And while the introductory verse mentions both zemen and eight, The list in verses 2 to 8 uses a sequence of 8 la this and va 8 la that. This list only has the word 8. It does not have the word zemen. And that's left for us to discover. Now, our translations make this sound like a list of infinitives, a time to give birth and a time to die. And this leaves us feeling like we've been given some sort of checklist or a life experience scavenger hunt. But I want to suggest we translate that lamed differently to uncover some of the depth of the Hebrew and have a truer to form reading. We need to read it as a time toward birthing and a time toward dying. And now it's revealed that the world of time is not just a rigid schedule of separate events. Time is full of transitions and arrivals. And just as importantly, this list reveals that we are not designed to spend all of our time in flux between extremes. In between gathering stones and throwing stones away, we get to choose a different relationship to the stones. Perhaps we just have a season of looking at the stones. And I don't want to risk you getting bored with the list before we even look at it, so let's look at it now. A time toward birthing, a time toward dying, a time toward planting, and a time toward uprooting what is planted, a time toward killing, and a time toward healing, a time toward tearing down, and a time toward building up, a time toward weeping, and a time toward laughing, a time toward mourning, and a time toward dancing, a time toward throwing stones, and a time toward gathering stones, a time toward embracing, and a time toward refraining from embracing, a time toward searching, and a time toward giving up as lost, a time toward keeping, and a time toward throwing away, a time toward tearing apart, and a time toward sewing together, a time toward being silent, and a time toward speaking, a time toward love, a time toward hating, a time for war, a time for peace. We have times of transition, 8, and set times, zemen. We're told the seasons and we need to discover those times in between. Now, a pattern is a simple type of relationship between one or more objects. And by devoting time towards studying Ecclesiastes 3, one could develop a great understanding of both the basic types of patterns and the different ideas on the list. Take, for example, the simple and obvious discord created by the 14th item on that list. After 26 times toward, we hit a pair of times four. Now, Grant has taught on the concept of a menorah pattern several times, so I'm going to spare you another lesson on general principles, particularly looking at the time. But let's consider that these verses are a simple menorah pattern. If we were to grab on the outside ideas, we would be left with considering a time toward birthing and a time toward dying and a time toward war, or time for war and a time for peace. Now, the first step to understanding these times is to understand the critical words, which means finding them in their essential context. And to do that, we have to find verses. So first, in trying to understand a time towards birthing and a time toward dying, Luke 2, verse 7, "And Mary gave birth to her firstborn son, and she wrapped him in cloths and laid him in a feeding trough, because there was no room for them in the inn," a time towards birthing. Luke 23, verse 46, "And Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. Having said this, he breathed his last," a time toward dying. But what occupied this space between birth and death? Life. There was a zemen, a set time of life. Consider his life as expressed in Acts 10:38. "You know of Jesus of Nazareth, how God appointed him, anointed him with the Holy Spirit and with power, and how he went about doing good and healing all those who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him." Then we have to consider a time for war and a time for peace. Matthew 10:34. "Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword." Time for war. Ephesians 2:17. "He came and preached peace to you who are far away, and peace to those who are near." A time for peace. Then we need to consider what came in between. Perhaps Colossians 1:13. "For he rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of his beloved Son." Stepping away from chapter 3, I want to suggest two verses for your personal study. Ecclesiastes 7, verses 16 to 17 expresses, "Do not be excessively righteous. Do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Do not be excessively wicked and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time?" I think this verse would lend itself very well to a study where you compile the list of questions and then you set about finding the definition for each word involved. And then there's Ecclesiastes 9:4, which reads, "For whoever is joined with all the living, there is hope. Surely a live dog is better than a dead lion." I think this verse would provide a surprising amount of information if, in studying it, you were to work to connect it to as many other verses as possible. So Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes after an intense, systematic, and intentional exploration of worldliness and amorality. It's a difficult book to engage. It barely made the canon, and it is full of apparent paradox. And perhaps most discomfortingly, Ecclesiastes speaks in a very different tone than our world does. Moreover, its message is unclear and does not easily align with our lives. The siren call of consumerism pulls at us constantly, and alongside it is the relentless drone of amusement. It's a great struggle to live intentionally. We have one more verse to look at, and then I want to offer my personal response to Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 1:18 tells us, "In much chokmah there is much grief, and increasing da'at increases pain." Now, as a quick refresher, chokmah refers to the broad and abstract grasp, as well as the distinct flash of intuitive insight. Chokmah is that singular spark necessary to build a fire. Chokmah is the burst of intellectual energy that launches you into study, but it can also be that momentary, haunting sense that something is wrong with the world, and perhaps you can help fix it. Sometimes it's a quick glimmer of truth, like sunlight sparkling on a diamond. Other times it may be a swarm of fireflies set against a dark forest, or it can be a refreshing burst like the phosphorus spark of a match. Yet at other times it can resemble the muzzle flash of a cannon, the havoc of a late-night thunderstorm, or staring into the sun and burning your eyes. As we grasp chokmah and work on it, we step into binah, the realm of concrete development. Think of the quick action of seed hitting egg versus the 9 months of development that follows. Binah is the process of research that can last for months or years. It's a contemplation and meditation to formulate an actionable understanding of something you formerly merely grasped intuitively. In the movies, this is when you cue the montage scene. Binah is that laborious process of building lists, defining words, revising concepts. If chokmah is a spark, then binah is the collecting and preparing of piles of tinder, kindling, and logs, all while keeping that spark alive. Often the instant when we need to switch from chokmah to binah is a moment of crisis, and it tends to follow inevitably on the wings of a mountaintop faith experience. How many people have gone on a retreat, joined a study, or had that deep, moving moment of prayer or praise, and they've turned their lives around? But that moment faded into the past, and you returned to who you were. Something happens. It gives us this brief, deep insight to God, and then the insight fades. And we try to recreate that experience to get the feeling back, but we don't realize there was an actual closeness which created that feeling, which shaped the experience. We don't realize that it is God who places us on top of that mountain and says, "See how great this is? I'm going to return you to the bottom now, but climb. Climb and you can live here. Not for the feeling, but for that intimacy." And that brings us to Da'at. Da'at is a point of arrival. Chokmah is when I first saw my beautiful wife from across the room and said, "Maybe." And Binah was the dangerous pursuit. And Da'at was her reluctant, "Yeah." At that point, the chokmah was realized. Da'at can refer to something divine or mundane, but it always implies stepping out of the realm of an idea. In Genesis, we read Adam, Da'at, Eve. Da'at is that deep sort of knowing that has a physical, actionable component. Ecclesiastes 1:18, "In much chokmah there is much grief, and increasing da'at increases pain." I'll let you explore this verse deeper, but one quick insight. Part of Solomon's discomfort comes from comparing his present life to that advice he received so long ago. You remember Proverbs 31? "Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised." That word translated vain here is the same as vanity throughout Ecclesiastes, hevel. So we're left considering Solomon's parting advice from Ecclesiastes 12:13. The conclusion, when all has been heard, fear God, keep his commandments. Finally, we reach my conclusion. At the beginning, I said I'd offer a response. Ecclesiastes is a difficult and a deep book, and the more you study it, the more it creates this sense of dissonance and discord. But to me, Ecclesiastes reinforces my sense that something is wrong with this world, and that what I see is not necessarily that which is real. Now, if we were playing Jeopardy, and I was to say, "Hope in that which is unseen," You would answer, what is faith? And I would say, wrong. The answer is faithfulness. What is faithfulness? Because faithfulness, like peace and love, is something to be exercised. It's not some inert possession. It has more in common with your muscles than your skeleton. Your skeleton is just there, but your muscles need to be exercised. Some people naturally have big muscles. Some people look like me. And if anyone neglects their muscles, though, they shrink. If you work them out, you grow. Now, the fruits of the Spirit are living and growing. And like that rabbinic commentary about the tree of life, the fruit is the tree. So with what mechanism do we exercise faithfulness? We're souls gifted with a set of attributes to engage the world, but how do we use them? In the physical realm, if we have a hammer, we grasp it with our hands and we swing it with our arm. But what about the soul realm? What do we use for this faithfulness? Our imagination. Consider for a second how your imagination allows you to momentarily suspend disbelief. That opening romance in the classic Pixar animated movie Up, that's a fictional story about pretend people. Moreover, they're mere animations. They're not flesh and blood. And yet we come ready to engage. And I weep that entire time. It's beautiful. Let's be real. But why? Suspension of disbelief. I came to be affected. I came to imagine a different world. Consider Chaim Potok's The Chosen. That's a mere collection of ink on paper. Yet at the end I weep. I literally have water stains on the last half of the book. Why? Imagination. The imagination is the tool with which we construct unseen worlds. It frees us from the bounds of the physical, the temporal, even the real. And just like playing with a plastic hammer as a child prepares us for using a real hammer as an adult, with faith we use those same muscles as with our imagination. But we use it to see past this physical world under the sun, to see reality in all its depth. There's a quote I enjoy, penned by Walter Brueggemann, whose book I do not recommend reading outside a study group. But he says, "We must ask not whether it is realistic or practical or viable, but whether it is imaginable." And elsewhere he says, "Questions of implementation are of no consequence until the vision can be imagined." So this concept I'm presenting as a response to Ecclesiastes is called the prophetic imagination. It's something that thrusts you into the realm of the radical. It's one of the principal elements of childlike faithfulness. It's a part of us that reads scripture and imagines fulfillment rather than leaving it as dead letters on a page. It's the part that reads and then asks, "What if I really believe that man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God?" It's the part that reads and asks, "What if I really believe that peacemakers are blessed because they shall be called sons of God?" It's the part that reads and asks, "What if I believed no one can serve two masters?" So this question creates room for the imagining, which becomes the vessel for the chokmah. The answer to prophetic questions grows from the spirit into the soul and then into action. I, for one, believe that we should always be nurturing dreams in our soul that are not yet attainable in this world. So with the questions generated by reading Ecclesiastes, we need to begin tearing down that illusory world of consumption and begin to see this world with bright eyes. We need to grow toward being a steward of this life, not a wasteful absolute monarch. Begin to see people not as nuisances, but as images of God. And that is a struggle. I believe that Solomon found himself trapped in this world, a world that was fading like the morning fog before the rising sun. As his last days approached, he realized that so many of the things he treated as real and meaningful were in fact vanity. And we cannot make that same mistake. We must see the world as it is. When our bodies return to dust, what if the world we saw daily, instead of fading away, what if the world we saw became clearer? What if I believed the kingdom of heaven is at hand?